Moralia, precepta gerundi reipublici. If it were fitting to use for some other purpose, Menemachus, the words, no one of all the Achaeans will fault your speech, nor will he speak against it in turn. Yet you have not reached the end of your speech. I would say them to those philosophers who exhort, but teach nothing and lay down no precepts. For they are like men who trim the wicks of their lamps, but pour in no oil. Seeing you then, roused as befits your noble birth in your homeland, to be both a speaker of words and a doer of deeds. And since you have no time to observe at close range, in the open air of practical affairs and public contests, the life of a philosophical man, and to become a spectator of examples brought to completion in deed and not merely in word, but ask instead to receive precepts for political life, I think it in no way fitting for me to refuse. And I pray that the work may prove worthy both of your zeal and of my own eagerness. As you requested, I have made use of rather varied examples. First, then, let it be laid down, as a foundation for a constitution like the one set out in these, precepts for the conduct of public affairs. That one's choice of a political career rests on a ground firm and strong, namely a judgment and reasoning that has its origin in decision, and not a headlong impulse born of empty ambition or some love of contention, or of a lack of other occupations. For just as those who have nothing worthwhile to do at home spend most of their time in the marketplace, even when they have no need to, so too some people, having no worthy private business of their own to pursue, throw themselves into public affairs, treating political life as a pastime. And many who have laid hold of public business by chance and become filled with it are no longer easily able to withdraw, suffering the same fate as those who board a ship for a pleasure sail and are then swept out to sea. They look outward, seasick and troubled, while being compelled to remain and make use of what is at hand. Beneath a calm sea's surface, the fair-faced loves of the ship's cable, cleaver of the deep, passed by them, to their divine ruin. It is these men above all who bring the profession into disrepute through their regret and vexation. Whenever, having hoped for reputation, they fall instead into disrepute, or, having expected to become objects of fear to others through their power, they are instead led into affairs full of dangers and turmoil. But the man who, as is most fitting for him, begins to conduct public business as the noblest of tasks, from settled judgment and reasoning, is not struck with dismay by any of these things, nor does he change his mind. For one should not enter public affairs for the sake of business and profit, as did the associates of Stradocles and Dramaclides, who used to summon one another to what they jokingly called the golden harvest, meaning the speaker's platform. Nor should one enter it as though suddenly overcome by some passion, as Gaius Gracchus did, who, in the heat of his grief over his brother's misfortunes, had set his life at the furthest remove from public affairs. But then, inflamed with anger at the insolence and abuse of certain men toward him, plunged into politics. And quickly he was filled to overflowing with business and reputation. But when he sought to stop and desired change and quiet, he could not find a way to lay down his power because of its very greatness, but was destroyed before he could do so. And those who, out of rivalry or love of reputation, fashion themselves like actors for the stage, are bound to feel regret, either enslaved to those they claim to rule or offending those they wish to please. But just as, I think, those who fall into a well by accident and without forethought are thrown into confusion and regret it, while those who climb down deliberately and with reasoning make calm use of the circumstances, and are moderate, and are vexed at nothing, since they have the good itself, and nothing else as the end of their actions. So too, once a man has firmly fixed his resolve within himself and made it unchanging and hard to alter, he must then turn to the study of the character of the citizens, which appears and holds sway most of all when blended together from all of them. For it is neither easy nor safe for a man straightaway to attempt to shape and remold the nature of the people, but this requires much time and great power as well. Rather, just as wine at first is mastered by the temperament of the drinker, but gradually, as it warms and blends with him, itself shapes and transforms the drinker. So the statesman, until he has built up an influence that carries conviction from reputation and trust, must be well attuned to the dispositions that already exist, and aim at these, understanding what the people delight in and by what they are naturally led. For instance, the Athenian people are easily moved to anger, easily turned to pity, wishing rather to suspect quickly than to be instructed calmly. Just as among individuals they are more eager to help the obscure and lowly, so among speeches they welcome and prefer the playful and the amusing. Those who praise them they especially delight in, while those who mock them they resent least. They are fearsome even to their own magistrates, yet humane even toward their enemies. Different is the character of the Carthaginian people. Harsh, sullen, submissive to their rulers, oppressive to their subjects, most base in fear, most savage in anger, tenacious of decisions once made, unresponsive to play and charm, and hard. These people would never. When Cleon asked them, since he had made sacrifice and was about to entertain guests, to postpone the assembly, have laughed and applauded and risen to their feet, nor, when a quail escaped from Alcibiades' cloak while he was speaking, would they have joined eagerly in the hunt and given it back to him. Rather, they would even have killed him, as one guilty of insolence and self-indulgence, seeing that they even drove out Hanno, on the charge of harboring tyrannical designs, merely for using a lion to carry his baggage on campaigns. Nor, I think, would the Thebans have refrained from reading letters of the enemy, had they gained possession of them, as the Athenians did when they captured Philip's letter carriers bringing a letter addressed to Olympias. They did not open it or reveal the private affectionate message of a man abroad to his wife. Nor again would the Athenians have easily borne the arrogance and pride of Epaminondas, when, refusing to defend himself against the accusation, he rose from his seat and walked out through the assembly to the gymnasium, as they in fact did bear it with ease. And it would have taken much more still for even the Spartans to endure the insolence and buffoonery of Stradocles, who persuaded them to offer sacrifices of good news as though they had won a victory. And then, when the true report of their defeat arrived and they grew indignant, ask the people what wrong had been done to them, since they had been happy for 3 days on his account. Now the flatterers at court, like birdcatchers imitating the cry of their prey and making themselves resemble it, insinuate themselves most effectively and win access to kings through deception. But it is not fitting for the statesman to imitate the temper of the people. Rather, he must understand it and know how to use it toward each end by which it can be won over. For ignorance of character brings about failures and disasters in political life no less than in the friendships of kings. The character of the citizens, then, once a man has gained influence and is already trusted, he must try gently to reshape, drawing them gradually toward what is better and handling them mildly. For the transformation of the masses is a difficult undertaking. And he himself, as one who will live the rest of his life, as it were, in a theater open on every side, must train and adorn his own character. And if it is not easy to rid the soul entirely of its faults, at least he should remove and curtail whatever failings bloom most conspicuously and are most likely to come to light. For you have heard that Themistocles, when he resolved to enter public life, gave up drinking parties and revelry, and, being sleepless, sober, and full of care, used to say to his companions that Milchiades' trophy would not let him sleep. And Pericles changed even his bodily bearing and manner of life. He walked gently, spoke mildly, always kept his countenance composed, and kept his hand drawn in beneath his cloak, and walked always by the one path leading to the speaker's platform and the council chamber. For it is neither easy to manage nor simple to achieve that saving capture of the multitude by just anyone. Rather, one must be content if, by being startled by neither sight nor sound, as a wild and unpredictable beast might be, one can win the people's confidence in one's leadership. If then, even these outward matters must not be neglected carelessly, how much less should one neglect one's life and character, so that they may be pure of all reproach and slander? For those engaged in public affairs give an account not only of what they say and do in public, but their dinners too are pried into, and their bed and their marriage and their amusements and every serious pursuit. Why need one even speak of Alcibiades? Though the most energetic of all in public affairs and an undefeated general, it was his unrestrained and reckless manner of living that destroyed him, and made his city unable to profit from his other good qualities, because of his extravagance and licentiousness. Even Simmons' fondness for wine was held against him by these same men, and the Romans, having nothing else to say against Scipio, blamed him for his fondness for sleep. And Pompey, the great, was reviled by his enemies, who noticed him scratching his head with a single finger. For just as a mole or a wart on the face causes more displeasure than scars, blemishes, or wounds on the rest of the body, so small faults appear great when seen in the lives of rulers and statesmen, on account of the reputation that most people attach to power and public office, as though it were a great matter that ought to be free of every impropriety and error. It was fitting, then, that Livius Drusus, the popular leader, won esteem because, when many parts of his house lay open to the view of his neighbors, and one of the builders offered to screen them off and rearrange them for only 5 talents, he said, "Take 10 and make my whole house visible, so that all the citizens may see how I live." For he was in truth a temperate and orderly man. Yet perhaps he had no need of this exposure at all, for the multitude discern even the characters, plans, actions, and lives of statesmen that seem very deeply concealed, loving and admiring one man and resenting and despising another, no less on account of their private than their public conduct. What then? Do not cities also make use of men who live licentiously and dissolutely? Indeed, just as pregnant women crave stones and seasick people often crave briny foods and the like, then a little later spit them out and turn away in disgust, so too the people, through luxury and insolence, for lack of better leaders make use of whoever is at hand, loathing and despising them all the while, and yet delight in having such things said to them as Plato the comic poet makes the people itself say. Take hold of my hand as quickly as you can, for I am about to appoint Agirius general. And again, asking for a basin and a feather so that it may vomit, saying, Manches stands before me at the platform and feeds Cephalus, that most hateful disease. And the Roman people, when Carbo made some promise and added an oath and a curse besides, swore back in unison that they did not believe him. And in Sparta, when a certain Demosthenes, a licentious man, spoke an opinion that happened to be sound, the people rejected it. But the ephors, choosing one of the elders by lot, ordered him to speak that very same proposal, as though pouring it from a foul vessel into a clean one, so that it might become acceptable to the many. So great is the weight that trust in one's character carries in public life, and its opposite as well. Not that, on this account, one should neglect the charm and power of speech, while placing the whole of virtue in conduct. Rather, holding rhetoric to be not the creator but the helper of persuasion, one should correct Menander's saying, "It is the speaker's character, not his speech, that persuades." For both character and speech together do the work, unless indeed someone will say, as one might claim that it is not the rudder that steers the ship, and not the bridle that turns the horse, so too it is not by speech but by character, used as a rudder and bridle, that political virtue persuades a city, virtue being, as Plato says, the most easily turned of all creatures, guided as it were by the stern and steered aright. For where even those great kings, sprung from the gods, as Homer says, magnify themselves with purple robes and scepters and spearmen and oracles of the gods, and hold the multitude in subjection by their majesty as being their superiors, nevertheless they wish to be speakers of words as well, and did not neglect the grace of speech, nor of assemblies, by which men become distinguished. Nor did they seek only Zeus the counselor, nor Ares the war god and Athena the warrior goddess, but they also called upon Calliope, who attends upon reverend kings, soothing with persuasion and charming away the people's stubbornness and violence. How indeed could it be possible for a private individual, from a common cloak and a plebeian bearing, wishing to lead a city, to prevail and gain mastery over the multitude, unless he possessed speech that could win them over and draw them along? For those who pilot ships employ other men as bosuns to call the time, but the statesman must have within himself both the mind that steers and the speech that gives the command, so that he has no need of a foreign voice, nor, like Iphicrates, out-argued by the followers of Aristophanes, must he say, "The actor of my opponents is better, but my own drama is better." Nor need he often resort to those famous lines of Euripides. Would that the race of wretched mortals were voiceless, and alas, alas, that men's affairs have no voice of their own, so that clever speakers would count for nothing. These sentiments perhaps may be left to alchemines and nesiotes and ictinus, and to all craftsmen and artisans who disclaim any ability to speak. Just as at Athens, once when two architects were being examined for a public work, the one, smooth and clever in speech, moved the people by delivering a well-rehearsed speech about the construction, while the other, better in his craft but unable to speak, came forward and said only, "Men of Athens, whatever this man has said, I will actually do." For only those honor Athena ergon alone, as Sophocles says, who work beside the anvil, with heavy hammer, fashioning lifeless matter that submits to their blows. But the prophet of Athena Polias and of Themis the counselor, who both dissolves and convenes the assemblies of men, employing a single instrument, speech, molding and fitting some things together, and softening and smoothing other things that resist his work, like knots in wood or flaws in iron, thereby adorns his city. It was for this reason that the government under Pericles was, as Thucydides says, in name a democracy, but in fact rule by the first man, because of the power of his speech. For Cimon too was a good man, and so were Ephialtes and Thucydides. But when this last Thucydides was asked by Archidamus, king of the Spartans, whether he or Pericles wrestled better, he replied, "One could not say. For whenever I throw him in wrestling, he claims he was not thrown at all, and he wins the argument and convinces the onlookers." This brought fame not to that man alone, but salvation to the city as well. For by trusting and obeying him, the city preserved its existing prosperity, but kept himself out of everything else. Nicias had the same policy, but lacked that kind of persuasive power, and trying to turn the people away with an argument as blunt as a dull bit, he could not restrain or master them, but was swept along by force into Sicily and dragged down along with them. They say, indeed, that no one can hold a wolf by the ears, but a people and a city must above all be led by the ears, not, as some untrained speakers do, hunting for coarse and inartistic handles on their arguments, tugging the crowd along by the belly, feasting them or handing out money, or by staging gladiatorial shows and Pyrrhic dances, always currying favor with the people, or rather flattering the mob. For leadership of the people is persuasion through speech, whereas such taming of the masses differs in nothing from the hunting and herding of irrational animals. The statesman's speech, however, should be neither youthful and theatrical, as though he were weaving garlands for a festival out of soft and flowery words, nor again, as Pythias said of Demosthenes' style, smelling of the lampwick and of sophistic overlaboration, with bitter figures of thought and periods measured out with ruler and compass. Rather, just as musicians insist that the touch of the strings should show itself expressive of character, not merely percussive, so in the speech of the man engaged in politics, advising, and ruling, there should appear neither cleverness nor cunning. Nor should he pride himself on speaking in a habitual, technical, or overly analytical manner. Instead, his speech should be full of unaffected character, genuine high-mindedness, a father's frankness, forethought, and caring intelligence, having along with the good the quality of being pleasing and persuasive, drawn both from dignified words and from ideas that are original and convincing. Political speech admits more readily than forensic oratory the use of maxims, historical illustrations, fables, and metaphors, by which those who employ them in moderation and at the right moment are especially effective, as the man who said, "Do not make Greece one-eyed," and Demades, who said the city was governing itself by shipwrecks, and Archilochus, "Let not the stone of Tantalus hang over this island," and Pericles bidding them remove the bleariness from the Piraeus. And Phocion, at the time of Leisthenes' victory, saying that the sprint was fine, but that he feared the long-distance race of the war. In general, weight and grandeur suit the statesman better. Examples are the Philippic speeches, and among Thucydides' set speeches, Asthenelaidas as reported by Ephorus, and that of King Archidamus at Plataea, and Pericles' speech after the plague. But as for the rhetorical displays and periods of Ephorus, Theopompus, and Anaximenes, which they draw out after arming and drawing up their armies in battle formation, one may say of them, none of that dulls the edge of steel nearby. Nevertheless, wit and jest sometimes properly form part of political oratory, provided it is not used for insolence or buffoonery, but is spoken usefully, in rebuke or in exposing folly. Such things are best received when used in exchanges and responses. For a jest that is premeditated and initiated unprovoked smacks of buffoonery and carries a reputation for malice, as attached to the jests of Cicero and of Cato the Elder and of Euxithius, the companion of Aristotle, for these men often mocked others when they themselves began the exchange. But when a man is defending himself, the occasion grants him both pardon and goodwill at once, as it did Demosthenes against the man who accused him of theft while mocking his habit of writing by lamplight at night. "I know I annoy you by burning my lamp." And against Demades shouting that Demosthenes wants to correct me, the sow correcting Athena, Demosthenes replied, "Yet this very Athena was caught committing adultery last year." Charming, too, was Xeninetus' reply to the citizens who reviled him because, though a general, he had fled. "Yes, together with you, dear friends." One must be very much on guard, however, against excess in jesting, and against whatever pains the hearers unseasonably or makes the speaker himself appear ignoble and mean, as happened with Democrat's sayings. When he went up to the assembly, he said that, like the city, he was weak in strength but strong in bluster. And again, at the time of the Chaeronea disaster, coming before the people, he said, "I would not have wished the city to have fared so badly that you should be listening even to my advice." The first remark was rather petty, the second nearly insane, and neither is fitting for a statesman. Phocion's terseness of speech, on the other hand, was much admired. Polyeuctus used to declare that Demosthenes was the greatest orator, but that Phocion was the most powerful speaker, since his speech packed the most sense into the fewest words. And Demosthenes himself, contemptuous of the others, used to say, whenever Phocion rose to speak, "Here comes the cleaver of my speeches." You should try, above all, to use speech that is well considered and not empty when addressing the masses, and to do so with security, knowing that even the great Pericles used to pray, before addressing the people, that no word irrelevant to the matter at hand might occur to him. Nevertheless, one's speech must also be kept versatile and well exercised for exchanges, since the occasions in political life are sharp and often bring sudden emergencies. This is why Demosthenes, they say, was outdone by many speakers when it came to unforeseen occasions, since he shrank back and hesitated. Whereas Theophrastus records of Alcibiades that he not only knew what needed to be said, but also how it should be delivered, though often, in the very act of speaking, while searching for and composing his words, he would falter and break down. But the man who rises to speak prompted by the actual circumstances and by the pressing occasion has the greatest power to strike his audience with amazement, win them over, and change their minds. As, for instance, Leon of Byzantium, who once came to address the Athenians while they were in the midst of civil strife. Seen to be short of stature and laughed at, he said, "What would you say if you saw my wife, who barely reaches my knee? Yet small as we are, when we quarrel with each other, the city of Byzantium cannot contain us." This produced even greater laughter. And Pythias the orator, when he was speaking against the honors proposed for Alexander, and someone said to him, "How dare you, so young, speak on matters of such magnitude?" replied, "Why, Alexander himself is younger than I am, and you are voting to make him a god." One needs, too, soundness of voice and strength of breath for the contest of politics, which is not a trivial bout but an all-out fight, so that his speech, thus trained, will not repeatedly give out and fail, letting some raucous bawler with a voice like a roaring torrent overpower him. Cato, on matters where he had no hope of persuading the people or the Senate because they had been won over beforehand by favors and canvassing, would simply rise and speak for the whole day, thereby using up the time allotted for the vote. On the preparation and use of speech, then, this much should suffice for one able to work out the rest for himself. There are two ways of entering upon political life. The one is quick and brilliant in reputation, though not without danger. The other is more pedestrian and slower, but has the advantage of greater safety. Some men, as though setting out at once on some grand, conspicuous action performed on the open sea, one that demands boldness, launch themselves straight into politics, believing Pindar to be right when he says that at the beginning of a task one must set up a shining facade. For the multitude receive more readily, out of a certain satiety and surfeit with the familiar, a man who is just beginning, as spectators do a new contestant, and offices and powers that show a brilliant and rapid rise dazzle envy itself. As Ariston says, fire does not produce smoke, nor does glory produce envy, if it blazes up at once and quickly. But things that grow little by little and slowly are overtaken bit by one rival after another from every side. Which is why many men have withered away around the speaker's platform before they ever came into bloom. But wherever, as they say of Lotta's the runner, the sound of the starting gate was still in his ears, when he was already being crowned as ambassador, or celebrating a triumph, or commanding gloriously, there neither the envious nor the contemptuous have equal power against him. It was in this way that Aratus came into fame, having made the overthrow of the tyrant Nicocles the starting point of his political career. It was in this way that Alcibiades rose, by organizing the Mantinean coalition against the Lacedaemonians. Pompey, too, thought fit to celebrate a triumph before he had ever even entered the Senate, and when Sulla would not allow it, said, "More people worship the rising sun than the setting one." And Sulla, on hearing this, yielded. And the Roman people did not, from some office that came his way by chance, suddenly appoint Cornelius Scipio consul in defiance of the law while he was seeking the aedileship. Rather, they did so because they had already admired, when he was a mere youth, his single combat and victory in Spain, and, a little later, his exploits as military tribune at Carthage, exploits about which the elder Cato himself exclaimed, "He alone has wisdom, the rest flit about like shadows." Now, however, since the affairs of our cities no longer involve commands in wars, nor the overthrow of tyrannies, nor dealings with allies, what conspicuous and brilliant beginning to a political career could a man still find? There remain the public lawsuits and embassies to the emperor, which require a man of fervent spirit who combines both courage and good sense. There is also much that has been allowed to lapse among the noble practices of our cities, and much that has crept in through base custom to the city's shame or harm, which a man can take up, correct, and thereby turn attention toward himself. Indeed, a great case well argued, trustworthy advocacy on behalf of a weak party against a powerful opponent, and outspokenness on behalf of justice against a wicked governor, have established some men at the outset of their political career in high repute. Not a few, too, have risen to prominence through enmity, by attacking men who held a position that was both envied and feared. For at once the strength of the man overthrown passes to the victor, along with an even better reputation. To attack a good man who holds the first place through his own virtue, out of envy, as Simmias attacked Pericles, Alcmaeon attacked Themistocles, Clodius attacked Pompey, and Menecleides the orator attacked Epaminondas, is neither good for one's reputation nor otherwise advantageous. For whenever the multitude, having wronged a good man, then quickly, as commonly happens, repent in their anger, they consider the easiest defense also the most just, to destroy the man who persuaded and instigated them. But to rise up against a base man who has made the city subject to himself through recklessness and cunning, such as Cleon was at Athens, and Cleophon, and to overthrow and humble him makes for a brilliant entrance onto the stage of political life, as it were the opening scene of a drama. I am not unaware that some men, by curbing an oppressive and oligarchic council, as Ephialtes did at Athens and Phormio among the Eleans, have gained both power and reputation at once. But this course carries great danger for a man just beginning his political career. That is why Solon took the safer path, when the city was divided into three factions, that of the so-called men of the hills, that of the men of the plain, and that of the men of the coast. By attaching himself to none of them, but remaining common to all, and saying and doing everything toward concord, he was chosen lawgiver to reconcile their differences, and thus established his own leadership. Such, then, in number and kind, are the beginnings available for the more conspicuous entrance into political life. But the safe and unhurried path was the one chosen by many famous men, Aristides, Phocion, Pamenes the Theban, Lucullus at Rome, Cato, Agesilaus the Lacedaemonian. Each of these, like ivy climbing and rising together with the strong trees it entwines, attached himself while still young and unknown to an older man already famous, and, gradually lifted up by that man's influence and growing along with him, fixed and rooted himself firmly in political life. Thus Aristides was raised up by Cleisthenes, Phocion by Chabrias, Lucullus by Sulla, Cato by Maximus, Epaminondas by Pamenes, and Agesilaus by Lysander. Though this last man, out of untimely ambition and jealous rivalry for glory, insolently and quickly cast off the very guide of his actions. The others, however, served their patrons well and in a truly political spirit to the very end, and added luster to them in return. Just as bodies exposed to the sun, while receiving its brightness, also increase and share back that same brightness. Those, at any rate, who envied Scipio used to declare that he was merely the actor of his exploits, and that Laelius, his companion, was their true author. Yet Laelius himself was never puffed up by any of this, but continued always to compete jointly for glory with Scipio's virtue and reputation. Afranius, again, a friend of Pompey, though a man of quite humble standing, was nonetheless expected to be elected consul. Yet when Pompey was working for others, he withdrew his candidacy, saying that attaining the consulship would not be as glorious for him as it would be painful and awkward if it came about without Pompey's willingness or cooperation. So, having waited patiently for just 1 year, he neither missed the office nor lost the friendship. Those who are thus led by the hand of others toward reputation gain the further advantage of winning the gratitude of many, and, if something unpleasant should occur, of incurring less hostility for it themselves. Which is why Philip advised Alexander to make friends, while it was still possible, by associating pleasantly and showing kindness while another man was still king. One must choose, as leader when beginning a political career, not simply the man who is famous and powerful, but the man who is such through virtue. For just as not every tree is willing to receive and support a clinging vine, but some choke and destroy its growth, so too in our cities, men who are not lovers of what is noble, but only lovers of honor and of power, do not offer young men opportunities for action. But as though the young man's reputation were food taken from their own mouths, they crush him down through envy and wither him, as Marius did in Africa and again in Gaul, where, after achieving many successes through Sulla's help, he ceased to employ him, resentful of his growing fame, and, using the seal ring as his pretext, cast him off. For Sulla, when he was serving as quaestor under Marius's command in Africa, had been sent by him to Bacchus and brought back Jugurtha as a prisoner. And being a young man eager for honor, only just having tasted glory, he did not bear his good fortune with moderation, but had an image of the deed engraved on a signet ring, showing Jugurtha being handed over to him, and wore it constantly. Marius, taking offense at this, cast him off. Whereupon Sulla went over to Catulus and Metellus, good men and opponents of Marius, and soon drove Marius out and crushed him in the civil war that came within a hair of overturning Rome itself. Sulla, on the other hand, promoted Pompey from his youth, rising from his seat and uncovering his head whenever Pompey approached, and gave the other young men too a share in commanding enterprises, even spurring some on against their will, and filled his armies with ambition and rivalry. And he prevailed over everyone, because he wished to be not merely first alone, but first and greatest among many great men. One must, therefore, hold fast to such men and attach oneself to them, not like Aesop's wren, which, carried up on the eagle's shoulders, suddenly flew off and got ahead of him, snatch away their glory for oneself, but rather receive it from them together with goodwill and friendship, since, as Plato says, those who have not first learned rightly how to be ruled cannot themselves rule well either. Capable of it. Next in order comes the question of the choice of friends, which endorses neither Themistocles' way of thinking nor Cleon's. For Cleon, when he first resolved to take up public affairs, gathered his friends together and dissolved his friendship with them, on the ground that friendship softened and distorted much of what should be a straight and just course of policy. But he would have done better to cast the love of money out of his soul and to purge himself of contentiousness, envy, and malice. For cities need not men without friends and companions, but men who are good and self-controlled. As it was, he drove away his friends, but 100 heads of fawning flatterers, as the comic poets say, wound themselves whimpering around him. And though he was harsh and heavy toward decent men, he in turn made himself subject to the many, currying favor with them like an old nurse, giving them pay they had not earned, and courting the basest and most diseased element of the populace against the best citizens. Themistocles, on the other hand, replied to the man who declared that he would rule well by showing himself impartial to all. "Never may I sit on such a throne, on which my friends would have no more from me than strangers." Nor was this man right either, in pledging that public policy and the common, public interest would follow friendship, and in subordinating them to private favors and personal zeal. And yet, to Simonides, when he asked for something unjust, he said, "Neither is a poet good who sings out of tune, nor a ruler decent who grants favors against the law. For it is truly dreadful and outrageous if a helmsman chooses sailors, and a shipowner chooses a helmsman, who know well how to set the tiller at the stern and the yardarm well when the wind rises, and if some master builder chooses assistants and craftsmen who will not ruin his work but will help bring it to its best completion. Yet the statesman, who is, in Pindar's phrase, a supreme craftsman and a maker of good order and justice, will not at once choose as friends helpers and fellow enthusiasts for the good men who share his temperament, but instead others who, for the sake of one need after another, bend him unjustly and by force. He will appear no different from some builder or carpenter who through inexperience and error uses corners, rulers, and levels by which his work is bound to be thrown out of true. For friends are the living and thinking instruments of statesmen, and one must not slip along with them when they go astray, but must take care that they do not make mistakes even unwittingly. This, indeed, is what disgraced Solon and brought him into disrepute with the citizens. For when he had conceived the plan of lightening debts, the Seisachtheia, as it was euphemistically called, meaning the cancellation of debts, and shared the plan with his friends before introducing it, they did a most unjust thing. They anticipated the law and borrowed large sums of money, and a short time later, when the law was brought to light, they were revealed to have bought splendid houses and much land with the money they had borrowed, while Solon incurred the charge of sharing in wrongdoing though he himself had been wronged. Agesilaus, in his zeal for his friends, became weakest and most abject toward himself, like the Pegasus of Euripides, cowering, yielding all the more one wished it. And by helping their misfortunes more eagerly than he ought, he seemed to make himself an accomplice in their injustices. Indeed, he saved Phoebidas when he was on trial for having seized the Cadmea without orders, saying that such things ought to be done on one's own initiative. And when Sphodrias was facing prosecution for a lawless and terrible act, for he had invaded Attica though the Athenians were friends and allies, Agesilaus, softened by the amorous pleading of Sphodrias' son, contrived to have him acquitted. And a letter of his to a certain ruler is reported in these words: "If Nicias is not guilty, acquit him, but if he is guilty, acquit him for my sake, in any case, acquit him." Phocion, however, did not even join his own son-in-law Chars in the trial concerning the Harpalus affair, but said, "I made you my son-in-law for all just purposes," and went his way. And Timoleon of Corinth, when he could not persuade or dissuade his brother from his tyranny by teaching and entreaty, joined those who killed him. For one ought not to be a friend only up to the altar, in the sense of not joining in perjury, as Pericles once put it, but up to the point of all law, justice, and advantage. For to overlook this brings great harm both to oneself and to the community, as was shown by the failure to punish Sphodrias and Phoebidas. For it was they, not least, who plunged Sparta into the war of Leuctra. For in the case of moderate faults of friends, the reasoning proper to a statesman does not compel one to trample heavily upon them, but rather allows one, once the greatest matters of the state have been placed in safety, to help friends out of one's surplus, to stand by them, and to labor together on their behalf. There are also favors that arouse no envy. To help a friend to office rather than merely assisting him personally, to entrust him with some distinguished administration or a benevolent embassy, one carrying, say, the honors of a governor, or a mission to a city concerning friendship and concord. But if some task is difficult yet distinguished and important, one should first assign oneself to it, and only then choose one's friend for it, as Diome says. "If indeed you bid me choose a companion myself, how then could I forget godlike Odysseus?" And Odysseus in turn fittingly repays the compliment. "These horses, old man, are newcomers, Thracian, whom you ask about, their lord good Diome slew, and beside him 12 companions, all the best. This is the yielding proper toward friends. It adorns those who praise no less than those who are praised, whereas self-will, as Plato says, dwells with solitude. Further, one must also let one's friends share in fine and generous favors, and bid those who have been benefited praise and love them too, as having been both the cause and the counselors of the benefit. But base and improper requests one must brush aside, not harshly but gently, teaching and consoling, explaining that they are not worthy of the friend's virtue and reputation. Best of all men in this was Epaminondas, who, when Pelopidas asked him to release the tavern keeper from prison, refused, but shortly afterward, when his own beloved asked the same thing, released the man, saying, "Such favors, Pelopidas, are fit to be received from little mistresses, not from generals." Cato, however, acted with heavy-handed self-will when Catulus the censor, who was among his closest friends and intimates, sought the release of one of the men being tried under Cato's quaestorship. Cato said, "It is shameful that you, whose duty it is to make us young men behave, should be thrown out by our own attendants." For in fact it was possible for him to refuse the favor while still stripping the roughness and bitterness from his words, so as not to inflict the pain willingly, but only as compelled by the law and by justice. There are also, in public life, not ignoble ways of assisting friends toward making money when they are in need, as Themistocles did, who, after the battle, seeing a corpse wearing gold torques and a necklace, passed by himself, but turning to his friend said, "Take these for yourself, for you are not Themistocles." For public affairs often give the statesman this opportunity too, to benefit his friends. Not all men, of course, are Menemachuses. To one, then, entrust a paid advocacy on behalf of justice. To another, introduce a rich man who needs care and patronage. To another, join in some contracting venture or a lease that carries profit. Epaminondas, when a friend approached a certain rich man and asked him for a talent, bade him say that it was by Epaminondas' own order that he gave it. And when the man who was asked came and inquired the reason, Epaminondas said, "Because this man, though honest, is poor, while you are rich, having embezzled much from the city." And Xenophon says that Agesilaus took pride in enriching his friends while remaining himself superior to money. But since, as Simonides says, every lark must grow a crest, and every political community brings with it certain enmities and disputes, it is especially fitting that the statesman should have thought this matter through as well. Most people, then, praise Themistocles and Aristides for laying aside their enmity at the borders whenever they went out on an embassy or a military command, and taking it up again on their return. Some are extraordinarily pleased, too, by the example of Cratinas of Magnesia. Opposing in politics Hermias, a man of no great power but ambitious and brilliant in spirit, when the Mithridatic War broke out and he saw the city in danger, Cratinas told Hermias to take over the government and manage affairs himself, while he would withdraw. But if Hermias preferred that he himself command, then Hermias should get out of the way, so that by rivaling one another in ambition, they should not destroy the city. The proposal pleased Hermias, and saying that Cratinas was more skilled in war than himself, he withdrew quietly with his children and wife. Cratinas escorted him on his way, giving him from his own money whatever would be more useful to a man in exile than to one under siege. And then, commanding the city most excellently, preserved it against all hope when it had come within a hair's breadth of destruction. For if it is noble and a mark of a great spirit to proclaim, "I love my children, but I love my country more," how is it not more fitting for each man to say instead, "I hate so-and-so and wish to do him harm, but I love my country more"? For unwillingness to be reconciled with an enemy, for the sake of the very things for which one ought even to give up a friend, is savage and beastly in the extreme. Better, however, were the followers of Phocion and Cato, who did not treat political disagreements as personal enmity at all, but were formidable and unyielding only in public contests, refusing to give up what was advantageous, while in private matters they behaved without rancor and with kindness even toward those with whom they had differed in the public sphere. For one ought to regard no citizen as an enemy, unless someone, like Aristion or Nabis or Catiline, becomes a disease and an abscess of the state. but those who are merely out of tune otherwise should be brought gently into harmony, as a musician tightens and loosens strings, not falling upon their errors with anger and insult, but rather in Homer's more moral vein. My friend, I did think you were wise in judgment beyond others, yet you know how to think of a better plan than this. And whenever they say or do something good, one should not be vexed at the honors they receive, nor stingy with kind words for their fine deeds. For in this way blame, where it is needed, will carry conviction, and we shall drive them toward vice while praising their virtue, comparing this conduct with the other as worthier and more fitting. I hold, too, that the statesman ought to bear witness to what is just even for his opponents, to help them when they are on trial against false accusers, and to distrust slanders directed at them, if these are alien to their known character. As that famous Nero did, who, shortly before he killed Thrasea, though he hated and feared him above all, nevertheless, when someone accused Thrasea of having judged a case badly and unjustly, said, "I could wish that Thrasea loved me as much as he is an excellent judge." It is no worse, too, in rebuking others who by nature are more prone to wrongdoing, to recall the character of some more refined enemy and say, "But that man would not have said or done this." One should also remind some men of their good fathers when they go astray, as Homer says, "Tydeus begot a son little like himself." And Appius, contending against Scipio Africanus in the elections, said, "How you would groan, Paulus, beneath the earth, if you perceived that your son, going down to canvass for the censorship, is escorted by Philonicus the tax farmer." For such remarks admonish wrongdoers, and at the same time do credit to those who administer the admonishment. And Sophocles Nestor answers in a statesmanlike way when reviled by Ajax, "I do not blame you, for though you speak ill of me, you act well." And Cato, when he had quarreled with Pompey over the matters in which Pompey and Caesar together were coercing the city, nevertheless, once they had come to war, urged that the supreme command be handed over to Pompey, adding that it belongs to the same men both to cause great evils and to put an end to them. For blame mixed with praise, containing no insolence but frankness, producing not anger but a sting and repentance, appears kindly and therapeutic. Abuse least of all becomes statesmen. Consider what was said against Aeschines by Demosthenes, and what Aeschines said against him in return, and again what Hyperides wrote against Demades. Would Solon have said such things, or Pericles, or Lycurgus the Spartan, or Pittacus of Lesbos? And yet even Demosthenes has abusive language only in his forensic speeches, while his philippics are free of both mockery and buffoonery of every kind. For such things shame the speakers more than those who hear them, and moreover they produce confusion in affairs and throw councils and assemblies into disorder. Hence Phocion acted best of all, yielding to a man who was reviling him and ceasing to speak. And when the man had at last, with difficulty, fallen silent, Phocion came forward again and said, "Well then, you have heard about the cavalry and the hoplites. It remains for me to go through the matter of the light troops and the peltastes. But since for many the thing is hard to restrain, and often revilers are usefully silenced by retorts, let the retort be brief in phrasing and show no anger or hot temper, but rather gentleness combined with playfulness and charm, biting in some fashion nonetheless. For it is retorts of this kind that turn back most sharply upon the one who provoked them. For just as, of missiles, those that are hurled back at the one who threw them seem to do so by some strength and solidity of the one struck deflecting them, so too what is said, spoken with the strength and intelligence of the one reviled, seems to turn back upon the revilers. As when Epaminondas answered Callistratus, who reproached the Thebans and Argives with the patricide of Oedipus and the matricide of Orestes. When we drove out the men who did these things, you took them in. And as the Spartan Antalcidas answered the Athenian who said, "We have often driven you from the Cephisus, but we have never driven you from the Eurotas." And Phocion too spoke gracefully when Demades shouted, "The Athenians will kill you." "Yes, if they go mad, but you, if they come to their senses." And Crassus the orator, when Domitius said to him, "Did you not weep for a lamprey you kept in a fish pond when it died?" retorted, "Did you not bury three wives without shedding a tear?" These things, then, have some use in the rest of life as well. As for participation in public affairs, some men enter into every branch of it, as Cato did, holding that a good citizen ought, so far as he is able, to leave no concern or care unattended to. And they praise Epaminondas because, when he was appointed to the post of Telearch out of envy, and as an insult by the Thebans, he did not neglect it, but said, that not only does office reveal the man, but the man also ennobles the office. He raised the post of street inspector to a great and dignified rank, though it had previously been nothing but a certain oversight of clearing dung from the alleys and diverting the flow of water. And I myself, to be sure, provide amusement to visitors, being seen often in public occupied with such things, but the saying remembered of Antisthenes helps me. When someone marveled that he carried saltfish through the marketplace himself, he said, for myself. I, on the contrary, say to those who reproach me, if I stand by while tile is being measured out, or clay and stones are being carried in, that I am not managing these things for myself, but for my country. In many other matters, a person might indeed seem petty and stingy, managing for himself and busying himself on his own account. But if it is done publicly, and for the sake of the city, it is not ignoble, rather, care and zeal extending even to small things is the greater thing. Others, however, think the practice of Pericles more dignified and magnificent. Among them is Critolaus the Peripatetic, who holds that, just as the ship Salaminia and the Perillus at Athens were launched not for every task, but were drawn down only for necessary and great enterprises, so too a man should keep himself for the most authoritative and greatest matters, as the king of the universe does. For God concerns himself with great things, but lets the small things go, leaving them to chance, as Euripides says. Nor indeed do we praise the excessive ambition and contentiousness of Thegeans, who, having won not only the circuit of the great games, but also many other contests, not only in the Pancratium, but also in boxing and the long race in the end, dining at a funeral banquet, as was his custom, when the portion had been served out to everyone, leapt up and fought a Pancratium bout, as if no one ought to win while he was present. Hence he amassed 1,200 wreaths, most of which one might consider mere rubbish. Those who strip for every political contest are no different from this man. Rather, they quickly make themselves objects of blame to the many, become burdensome, and are envied even when they succeed, and if they stumble they become objects of mockery, and the admiration they enjoyed at the outset of their zealous activity gradually subsides into ridicule and laughter. Such is the point of the saying, Mediocis commands the army, Mediocis oversees the roads, Mediocis watches the bread, Mediocis watches the meal, Mediocis mends everything, and Mediocis will come to grief. This man was one of Pericles' companions, and it was, it seems, through the power he derived from him that he acted so as to provoke envy and to excess. It is necessary, as they say, for the statesman to conduct himself toward the people as toward a lover, and not to leave behind, in his absence, a longing for himself. This is what Scipio Africanus used to do, living for long stretches in the countryside, at once relieving the weight of envy and giving breathing room to those who felt oppressed by his reputation. Timesias of Clazomenae, in other respects, was a good man with regard to the city, but because he did everything himself, he was envied and hated without realizing it, until something of this sort happened to him. Some boys were in the road digging a knucklebone out of a pit as he was passing by. Some of them said to leave it, but one of them, striking it, said, "So may I knock out Timesias' brain, as this thing has been knocked out." Timesias, hearing this and understanding that envy of him pervaded everyone, turned back, told the matter to his wife, and bidding her pack up and follow him, set out at once from his own doorway and left the city. Themistocles too, it seems, when something similar was directed at him by the Athenians, said, "Why, my good fellows, do you grow weary of being repeatedly well-treated?" Of such sayings, some are rightly said and some not well. In goodwill and solicitude, one must hold aloof from none of the public business, but must attend to everything and know each matter, and not, like a sacred vessel on a ship, lie stored away, waiting for the city's utmost needs and crises. Rather, as pilots do. Some things they perform themselves with their own hands, while others they direct through other instruments, sitting apart and through other people, turning and guiding them. They also make use of sailors, lookouts, and bosuns, and often summon some of these back to the stern and put the rudder into their hands. So it is fitting for the statesman to yield office to others and invite them to the speaker's platform with goodwill and kindness, and not to move everything in the city by his own speeches, decrees, or actions, but having trustworthy and capable men to fit each one to each task according to his aptitude. As Pericles employed Menippus for military commands, brought low the council of the Areopagus through Ephialtes, got the decree against the Megareans ratified through Charinus, and sent out Lampon as founder of Thurii. For it is not only that, when power appears to be distributed among many, the weight of envy troubles one less. It is also that the business at hand is more fully accomplished. Just as the division of the hand into fingers has not weakened its use, but made it skillful and versatile, so too the man who shares public business with others makes the joint action more effective. But the man who, out of an insatiable desire for glory or power, takes the whole city upon himself, and applies himself to something for which he is neither naturally suited nor trained, as Cleon did toward generalship, Philopoemen toward naval command, Hannibal toward public speaking, has no excuse when he fails, but hears applied to himself the words of Euripides. Though a carpenter, you were doing work not of carpentry, or though unpersuasive, you served as envoy, or though lazy, you managed the finances, or though ignorant of accounts, you served as treasurer, or though old and feeble, you commanded the army. Pericles, moreover, divided power with Cimon as well. He himself ruled in the city, while Cimon manned the ships and made war on the barbarians, for the one was better suited to statesmanship, the other to war. They also praise Eubulus of Anaphlystus, because, although he possessed trust and power in the highest degree, he took no part in the affairs of Greece and did not seek generalship, but devoting himself to the finances, increased the public revenues and greatly benefited the city through them. Iphicrates, by contrast, was mocked for practicing rhetorical exercises at home before many onlookers. For even had he been a good speaker rather than a poor one, he ought, since he cherished the reputation he had won under arms, to have left that pursuit to the sophists. Since every populace harbors a streak of malice and a readiness to find fault with those engaged in politics, and suspects many useful measures, if they meet with no opposition or debate, of being carried out by secret conspiracy. And this above all brings political associations and friendships into disrepute. One must leave oneself no genuine enmity or quarrel with anyone. So Onomademus, the popular leader of the Chians, after prevailing in civil strife, would not allow all their opponents to be expelled, lest, he said, we begin to quarrel with our friends once we are altogether rid of our enemies. That remark, however, is naive. But when the people at large regard some matter with suspicion, however great and salutary it may be, it is not right for everyone, as though arriving by prior arrangement, to voice the same opinion. Rather, two or three of one's friends should stand apart and mildly speak against it. Then, as though being won over by argument, change their position, for in this way they draw the people along, since the people seem to be guided by their own advantage rather than compelled. In lesser matters, however, that touch nothing important, it is no worse, indeed truer to life, to let one's friends genuinely disagree, each employing his own judgment, so that on the most weighty and important matters they may appear to agree on the best course not by prearrangement. Now the statesman is by nature always the ruler of his city, like a leader among bees, and, bearing this in mind, he must keep public affairs constantly in hand. But as for the offices that go by the name of authorities, to which men are elected, he should neither pursue them excessively or repeatedly. For love of office is neither dignified nor democratic, nor decline them when the people lawfully offer and summon him to them. Rather, even if they fall short of his reputation, he should accept them and share in the ambition to hold them, for it is right that a man honored by the greater offices should in turn honor the lesser ones. As for the weightier offices, such as the generalship at Athens, the prytany at Rhodes, and the boatarchy among us, one should relax a little and give way with moderation, while adding dignity and weight to the lesser ones, so that we may be neither despised in the latter nor resented in the former. When entering upon any office, moreover, one must have ready not only those considerations with which Pericles used to remind himself as he took up his cloak. Take heed, Pericles, you rule free men, you rule Greeks, you rule Athenian citizens, but must also say to himself, you rule as one who is himself ruled, in a city subject to proconsuls, to Caesar's agents. This is not the plain of the spear, nor the ancient Sardis, nor that famed Lydian power. He must make his cloak more modest, and look from the general's headquarters toward the speaker's platform, and not think too highly of the garland or place too much trust in it, seeing the soldier's boots above his head. Rather, he must imitate actors, who bring their own feeling, character, and dignity to the contest, yet listen to the prompter and do not overstep the rhythms and measures of the authority granted them by those who hold power. For a false step here brings not hissing, mockery, or catcalls, but for many it has brought the dread punisher, the axe that severs the neck, as it did to those associated with your own pardalas who forgot their proper bounds, while another, cast out onto an island, has become, in Solon's phrase, a man of Polgandros or Sicinus, having exchanged his Athenian homeland for that. When we see small children trying on their father's sandals and putting on their garlands in play, we laugh. But when rulers in our cities foolishly urge the multitude to imitate the deeds, ambitions, and actions of their ancestors, actions ill-suited to present circumstances, they stir the masses up, and having made themselves ridiculous, suffer things no longer merely laughable, unless indeed they are treated with utter contempt. For there are many other things from the earlier Greeks which, when recounted to men of today, can shape character and instill moderation, as at Athens, reminding people not of matters of war, but of things such as the decree of amnesty concerning the 30, the fining of Phrynichus for staging in tragedy the capture of Miletus, the fact that, when Cassander was refounding Thebes, the Athenians wore garlands in celebration, that, on learning of the club massacre at Argos, in which the Argives had killed 1,500 of their own citizens, they ordered a purification offering to be carried around the assembly, and that during the house searches in the affair of Harpalus, they passed over only the house of a man newly married. These are things it is even now possible to emulate, thereby making oneself like one's ancestors. But Marathon, and the Eurymedon, and Plataea, and all such examples as make the multitude swell up and bristle with empty pride, should be left behind in the schools of the sophists. It is not enough merely to keep oneself and one's country blameless before those in power. One must also always have some friend among those highest in authority, as a firm ballast for one's political career. For the Romans themselves are most eager to support the political ambitions of their friends, and it is a fine thing to turn the fruit one gains from a great man's friendship, as Polybius and Panaetius did through Scipio's goodwill toward them, greatly benefiting their own countries, to the public happiness. And Caesar, when he took Alexandria, kept Arius by the hand, and conversing with him alone among his companions, rode into the city with him. Then, when the Alexandrians expected the worst and begged for mercy, he said he was reconciled to them both because of the greatness of the city and because of its founder Alexander. And thirdly, he said, as a favor to this friend of mine. Is it really worth comparing to this favor the many talented stewardships and administrations of provinces, which most men, in pursuing them, grow old waiting at another man's door, having abandoned their own affairs at home? Or must we correct Euripides, who sings and says that if one must keep vigil and haunt another's gate and submit oneself to intimacy with the powerful, it is most noble to do so on behalf of one's country, while for other purposes, one should embrace and preserve friendships based on equality and justice. Yet in doing this, and in rendering one's country obedient to those in power, one must not further humble it, nor, when the leg is already bound, submit the neck as well, as some do, who by carrying matters both small and great to their rulers bring reproach on their own servitude, or rather destroy the political order altogether, rendering it terrified, timid, and powerless in everything. Just as those who have grown accustomed to neither dine nor bathe without a doctor's supervision do not even enjoy the health that nature grants them, so too those who bring every decree, every council session, every grant of favor, and every administrative matter before the ruling power force, those in authority, to be their masters more than the rulers themselves wish. The chief cause of this is the greed and contentiousness of the leading men. Either, in matters where they harm their lesser fellow citizens, they are driven to force them out of the city, or, in disputes among themselves, unwilling to accept a lesser standing among their fellow citizens, they bring in their superiors to intervene. From this, the council, the people, the courts, and every office lose their authority. One must, by soothing ordinary citizens with equal treatment and powerful men with mutual concession, hold them within the bounds of civic life and dissolve their disputes, treating this as a kind of secret political remedy for diseases, being willing oneself to be worsted among one's fellow citizens rather than to conquer through insolence and the overturning of the rights that belong to one's own country. Begging each of the disputants for further concessions, and teaching them how great an evil contentiousness is. As it is, rather than yield with honor and grace to fellow citizens, tribesmen, neighbors, and colleagues in office at home, men carry their quarrels off to the doors of orators and men of affairs, with great harm and shame. For physicians, in the case of diseases they cannot remove entirely, divert them out to the surface of the body. So too the statesman, if he cannot keep his city entirely free of trouble, will at least try, by concealing what is disturbed and factious within it, to heal and manage it, so that it may need outside doctors and remedies as little as possible. Let the statesman's guiding policy, then, be one that holds fast to safety and flees the disturbing madness of empty glory, as has been said. Yet in his disposition, there should abide an undaunted, bold-hearted, high-spirited resolve, of the sort that enters men who, on behalf of their fatherland, stand firm against hostile men, difficult circumstances, and adverse times, and fight to the end. For he must not himself stir up storms, but must not abandon ship when they fall upon it, nor stir the city into peril, yet when it stumbles. And to help it when it is in danger, taking up frank speech from it as a sacred anchor in the greatest crises, such as the troubles that overtook the people of Pergamum under Nero, and the Rhodians recently under Domitian, and the Thessalians earlier under Augustus, when they burned Petreius alive. On such occasions you would not see the true statesman drowsing or cowering, nor blaming others while setting himself outside the danger, but going on embassies, sailing, and speaking first, not saying, "We who did the killing have come, turn away destruction, Apollo." But rather, even if he had no share in the wrongdoing of the many, taking the risks upon himself on their behalf. For this is a noble thing, and beyond its nobility, the admired virtue and high spirit of a single man has often dimmed the anger felt against everyone and dissolved the fearsome bitterness of a threat. As seems to have happened to the Persian king in his dealings with Bulles and Sperthias the Spartans, and as happened to Pompey in his dealings with Aestheno, when Pompey was about to punish the Mamertines for their revolt. And Aestheno told him he would not be acting justly if he destroyed many innocent people for the sake of one guilty man, for he himself, the one who had led the city to revolt, was the one who had persuaded his friends and forced his enemies. This so affected Pompey that he not only let the city go, but treated Aestheno with kindness. Sulla's guest friend, faced with a like virtue but an unlike outcome, met a noble end. For when Sulla had captured Praeneste and was about to slaughter all the rest, he was ready to release that one man alone on account of their guest friendship, saying that he did not wish to owe his safety to the murderer of his country, and the man mingled himself among the citizens and was cut down together with them. Such crises, then, one must pray to avoid and hope for better things. Every office is a sacred and great thing, and one must honor the office holder above all. And the honor due to office is harmony and friendship toward one's colleagues in office far more than crowns and the purple-bordered robe. Those who suppose that serving in the army together and being young men together is the beginning of friendship, but that holding a joint command or joint magistracy is a cause of enmity, have not escaped one of three faults. Either they regard their colleagues as equals and so quarrel with them, or they envy those who are superior, or they despise those who are lowlier.